Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of The Diary of a CEO. In this episode, three leading voices in female societal issues engage in a thought-provoking discussion about the complexities of modern feminism. They explore how the movement has both empowered and divided women, examining the impact of societal expectations and the choices women face today. What are the consequences of these evolving gender roles? Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
The feminism movement didn't unite women, it split women.
I feel totally
Listen, 50% of young women don't want to have children. They're really preoccupied with making money and materialism.
But we're still looking at a society that is increasingly telling women where they could be better.
But sometimes feminism expects women to be prioritized, and both sexes want the privileges without the responsibilities.
Can I just add, we are producing women and men who are and I'll tell you what I mean by that. It'll be an interesting discussion.
We're joined by three leading and outspoken voices in female societal issues with very different opinions.
To unpack the choices and consequences women face in modern society.
The sexual revolution gave women freedom.
But things like the washing machine, women entering the labor force, the pill had enormous social changes. For instance, it gave the illusion that sex was consequence-free.
But the second wave of the feminist movement was every woman should want free sex. And yet, 82% of young women are depressed and anxious after casual sexual encounters. Or every woman should want to go out to work and leave their children in daycare. But we are doing terrible damage to our children by putting them in daycare.
This strain of feminism has basically aspired as much as possible to make women like men. And now gender roles are changing.
And we've gone so far, so we have women dominating men.
How are we dominating men, though?
Oh, my goodness. 60% of college students are women.
Let's not us dominating women.
Let me finish. Young men are afraid of women and the power they have over them.
Oh, God, to blame feminism for those things. I mean, it's insane.
But there are solutions.
I'm just going to jump in there and talk about a report that came out in 2025. And this was really shocking. What are your thoughts about this?
Okay,
so
first of all,
this has always blown my mind a little bit. Louise, what is your professional background and what do I need to understand and know about your experiences that feed into your perspective on this subject?
So my professional background, I'm a journalist. I write about ideas for a living. I don't have like a political agenda. I just write and say things that I think are true. In terms of how I arrived at some of my views on what we're going to talk about today, sexual revolution, I think I was raised with a lot of the assumptions around the sexual revolution, which are sort of like the water that we swim in now culturally. And it wasn't until I got to university that I started gradually unpicking them. After I left university, I worked in a rape crisis center, which was quite formative for me in that I saw some of the ways in which some of the feminist theory that I had learned at university didn't quite map onto reality. And then after leaving that job, I became a journalist. Again, I kept thinking about these things. And I guess I've reached a point where I take a very mixed view of this history. I think there are good things. I think there are bad things that have come out of the sexual revolution.
Louise, can you define for me what you mean by sexual revolution for anybody that doesn't know? Because it's going to be quite an important term today.
Right. So I think that there are two things, really. The ideological event, really, of the 1960s and 1970s. So this was a period of, not just in relation to sexual relationships, but all sorts of things, a period of really questioning and challenging traditional ideas, and particularly traditional Christian ideas, about what sexual relationships ought to look like. I think actually the point that we've reached in terms of progressive culture is the assumption that those traditional ideas are necessarily questionable, are necessarily fit to be challenged. I think that's the ideological thing that we're talking about. But there's this other thing that happens at the same time, which is partially connected, which is a material change. So you have the introduction of the pill, the advent of safe abortion. Remember, historically, abortion is not safe. So you have the advent of safe abortion and, of course, its decriminalization. You have things like the washing machine and central heating and all sorts of other domestic appliances, domestic technologies, which actually have been enormously important in changing sexual relationships because all of a sudden it means that it basically takes less time to run a home. And so it becomes more possible for women to enter the workforce. So then you see this wave of not only changing marriage rates and birth rates, but also women entering the labor force en masse. And really some enormous social changes, like so enormous that it can be a little bit hard in 2025 to realize how enormous they were because we've become used to them.
We'll talk about all of that today. Going clockwise then, Erica, same question to you about your background and the work that's fed into the perspective you have.
I'm a psychoanalyst in private practice. I'm an author. I write books about parenting. And the book I'm probably most well known for is my book, Being There. And it's basically about the neuroscience of attachment or the importance of mothers in the first 3 years of a child's life to create emotional security, which lays down the foundation for mental health in the future. And so from my perspective, I guess the conversation we're going to have, I should say right off the bat, I consider myself a feminist, but I consider myself a term that I like better. And that there was a school of thought called maternal feminism, which really elevated women in their work as mothers and really talked about it as very important work. And so I'm not an anti-feminist, and I'm certainly for women to have choice. So it'll be an interesting discussion. I guess you could say I'm more of a centrist on this topic. As Louise said, there are parts of feminism that I think really helped women, and there are parts that really did a lot of harm to children.
And lastly, Deborah.
Yes.
Same question to you.
So I am best known as the host of the Guilty Feminist podcast, and I started that podcast to learn about feminism. And I have since researched a lot. I wrote a book called The Guilty Feminist. I've just written a book called Six Conversations We're Scared to Have, which does also challenge some of the directions that we've gone, but more in about how combative we've become as progressive people to each other and how difficult it is to talk to people on the right now and how we need to get back in rooms and we need to be having difficult discussions like this. So it's interesting what Louise says about being raised in a progressive household, but then being disillusioned and thinking that there's some ways in which life was better before the sexual revolution, because I'm effectively a time traveler. I did live before the sexual revolution because when I was 14, just coming into my puberty, my family joined a religious cult. I didn't have any normal sexual development and I didn't get out. I didn't escape that patriarchal cult till I was in my mid-20s. So I know what it is and I do not believe women want it. I know what it is to not have autonomy, to not have agency, and to not have emotional freedom. And those are the three big things that I think the sexual revolution gave women. First of all, agency. I think it's just agency is so important. So agency is just the ability to go around and choose what you do moment to moment. And autonomy is, can I decide what my life looks like, the shape of my life? What choices do I have? And emotional freedom is the third one. And I don't think the sexual revolution did give us emotional freedom because I think we're still sitting in a lot of guilt as women as to like, if I'm at work, I should be at home with my children. If I'm at home with my children, am I providing for them financially well enough? Or am I going to have a career when I go back to work? If I'm doing both of those things very well, am I a good enough daughter, friend? Am I running a half marathon for charity? Like, we are in a stage of such guilt. That's why my show and one of my books is called The Guilty Feminist, because I felt that feminism had become another thing to feel guilty about.
With the weight of guilt still lingering in the air, the conversation shifts to the evolving expectations of today's youth in a rapidly changing sexual culture, where exploration and judgment intertwine.
That is exactly what I would expect to see.
You're talking about 18-year-olds that don't know themselves yet.
What we are currently experiencing in our sexual culture where, yes, there's some structure, yes, there are some rules, but we are much, much more sexually, not just liberal, but even libertine than, say, the sexual culture of our grandparents or whatever. I think everyone ought to be able to agree on that. There clearly is a change now in the sexual culture from previous generations, and it's mostly to do with the pill, as I argue. But the expectation is kind of, as you say, that you just have to figure it out. Like, there isn't a very clear template. Yes, maybe there isn't. I think that Deborah, you are actually right that most people do in the end aspire to monogamy and having children and everything. But there's also an expectation that you're supposed to experiment a bit in the meantime, and it's kind of actually weird to be a virgin on your wedding night. And I think that, yes, I mean, girls have to tread this really difficult tightrope where on the one hand they are at risk of slut shaming, but they're also at risk of being called frigid. They are much, much more at risk actually of being called frigid than in previous generations. And the idea that we can escape from social judgment around our sexual choices is probably not realistic. I think that basically that's what humans are like. We do just tend to be judgmental about this. But anyway, I don't think it's very wise to subject girls to this experience, is how I would put it, to say that you have to go through the hookup culture.
I know people who are opting out. I know young people who are absolutely opting out. They're not freedom at all.
I'm going to agree with her and say freedom has become a pressure. There's become a societal pressure to be free. So
I know many young people who are opting out of the apps.
Okay, I'm a therapist and I see so many young people and I give lectures and people come up to me. So I can say, and I write books about adolescence, and I'm going to say that mostly the term hookup culture is used between 15 and 30. So you're correct in saying a 32-year-old woman should have the right to have sex with whoever the hell she wants to have sex with. And I'm right there with you. She should have choice, whatever. But young women, young men who are developing emotionally, mentally,
should not have the right.
Can I finish?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, sorry. So you interrupted, so I didn't get to finish.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. So they're more vulnerable. They are more vulnerable emotionally to what the hookup culture does to them. There's a lot of research to say that it causes loneliness, depression, anxiety, tons of regret, embarrassment, shame, self-esteem issues. And so, of course, we want freedom. In fact, I'm probably more in agreement with you on most things than you think. But in this, I say that freedom can become its own prison. So if you think about the early feminists, the really early feminists, Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Shelley, those women were fighting patriarchy. They were fighting a system that said they had to be a certain way. So, of course, I don't accept what Iran does to women. I mean, that, you know. But what's happened is if the pendulum swings too far, you have a different kind of patriarchy on the other side. You know, we say the extreme left and the extreme right actually meet in the middle. And so have we just we never want to take choice away. The idea of taking choice away from women to have sex with whoever they want to have sex with, that's not the point of this. It's, have we created a society which pressures young women in its own way to be promiscuous, to have lots of experiences? It's not all glorious freedom. It is glorious, but it's also not all glorious.
Of course.
it can be a pressure on young people to get rid of their virginity, to have lots of sexual experiences. And it's not all it's cracked up to be for them. It really isn't. In terms of their mental health, again, they are more, we say, 9 to 25, really 27 in young men, is the second critical period of brain development, where they are very susceptible to their relational experiences and their environment. And so in that period of development, which is mostly what we use the term hookup culture for, it's in that very young developmental period. It's not just in college, it's throughout their 20s, you know, until that woman becomes 32. That's a very vulnerable brain.
Can I just say, though, again to the time traveler piece, I did not, like, you recommend, Louise, because I heard you talking on this podcast before, that people don't have sex till they're engaged. But if you're engaged, the next step is marriage. So presumably you're going to marry that person, i.e. you're going to sleep with. I do not recommend that, ideally, because I came from a religion where that was the only option. And because I didn't meet anybody, I atrophied. I had no intimacy. Mm. I felt so lonely. Now, you're saying sometimes people have a hookup and they feel lonely afterwards. Totally, of course. That's happened to everyone who's ever had casual sex in any quantity where you feel a bit like, oh, that didn't fill me up. It's like, you know, when they say you go and have a Chinese meal and you feel hungry half an hour later and you were wanting more. There is no utopia here. There's only options. And what happened to me, because I had no option, I had no autonomy, I became more and more atrophied, more and more lonely, more and more empty, more and more disconnected from myself. To this day, I struggle with that. I struggle with intimacy, with because we were in such a culture of you can't have sex before you get married that you didn't really make eye contact with people. You know, normal teenagers will sit on each other's laps and just experiment a little bit, or they might have a little kiss or whatever. If you don't have anything like that, you can't really look at people properly because, you know, oh, it might lead to something. It took me so long to heal, guys. And however old you think I was when I lost my virginity, I was older. And it was tough. Because if you're losing your virginity very late, the person you're losing it with has had a more regular, healthy, in my opinion, sexual development. They've had their first girlfriend or boyfriend. They've experienced a few things. It's still hard for me to say what I want. So I don't recommend the other thing either, which is don't have sex with anyone until you're ready to, prepared at least to marry them.
I've got a graph here that somewhat dovetails into this conversation about when you should have sex and also marriage as a subject. And it shows that from the 1970, roughly women would get married at about 21 years old. And now, this graph will be on the screen, it's about 30. Men used to get married at around 23 years old, and now it's just over 30, which is a pretty crazy climb. So it feels to me if the sexual revolution took place in around this era where we see this rapid climb, maybe the two are somewhat interlinked, i.e. the age in which we'd be getting married or having sex under Louise's, you know, potential advice that it's worth
better
to wait.
It's because of the pill. That's why that happened. Mm-hmm. It's because it used to be that if you were having sex with someone, you were risking pregnancy. And now that's not, I mean, it is still true because actually all contraception fails and something like half of women in this country get pregnant didn't mean to or whatever.
Having examined the shifting dynamics of marriage and sexuality, the conversation now pivots towards the impact of trauma on relationships, delving into how past experiences shape our connections with others.
But if you've had a lot of trauma, then you are not going to turn towards relationships and you are not going to turn towards men. If men traumatized you and you saw a man abuse your mother, of course you're not going to want men in your life. So a lot of it, I think the feminist movement does something, which it's, first of all, I'm going to say it's done a lot of good. I wouldn't be here. None of us would be here without it. Those women that took the risks, we have to be grateful toward. But I mean, what it also did is it distorted a lot of the importance of relationships and how important male and female relationships are. I'll stop there because I've talked too much. But
can I say something about agency? Because this work came up earlier, and I've been thinking a lot about it recently, and I just find it interesting as a subject. So I think that actually a better way of thinking about agency than is this binary thing that, you know, humans have agency, et cetera, is it's kind of more of a personality trait. I think that some people are very agentic. Some people are able to set their minds on doing something and they just make it happen. Those people are very well suited to making their own decisions. Those people hate the idea of any kind of limits on their freedom. But they are unusual people. Most people, actually, they go with the flow. They kind of do what other people around them are doing. They drift a little bit. They're a little bit passive. They kind of make decisions based on what seems normal. They follow the template as it appears to them in their moment. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean that those people are more vulnerable to bad scripts. Mm-hmm. The problem with the sexual liberation narrative is it assumes that everyone is highly agentic. It assumes that everyone is capable of being faced with all these various choices and saying, I'm going to choose this one and that one and making it happen, rather than what I think is more realistic, and particularly when you're talking about young people, and I think even more talking about young women, I think young women are particularly mimetic and particularly I mean, there are studies showing this, that women are, for instance, more likely to imitate other people's body language. They're more likely to, they pick up slang more quickly than men do. Like, young women are very socially attuned, like more than any other group. They're very alive to what's high status and low status and like keen to imitate it. You also see this with fashion, all sorts of things, right? I think to just say to those young women, good news, you can choose anything you want. You can do anything you want. Obviously, if you are highly agentic, I think you mentioned, Deborah, young people who are just like, no, I'm not into this, off the apps, not doing it. They're highly agentic. Mm. That's very impressive, but it's rare. Like, most people actually are basically going to do what their peers do. And so that's why I think just saying, give everyone choice and kind of close the lid and say, good luck. I think that doesn't work. I think that actually we need to be a bit more prescriptive.
Women were less agentic before the sexual revolution. Overall, as a population, we are more agentic now. We have more agency and we flex that agency more frequently. If you are worried that young women seem to you to be mimetic, i.e. influenced by their peer group, then we need education for what's happening in that peer group. I don't disagree with you that thinking about intimacy, thinking about, do I really want to do this with my body? Do I want to let this boy touch me here or there, or this girl, you know, do this or that with me or whatever? Of course. But that's education so they can have agency. And that's the discussion that the parents have, ideally the schools are having. We desperately need that.
That's what we're doing here, right? We're trying to.
Yeah.
But rather than saying they need rules, I would say they need to be further attuned to their own desires, their own body, their own environments, relationships. You know, how long does it feel right to me, listening to my own body, listening to my own mind, having confidants that they can talk to who are older and more responsible if they don't feel comfortable talking to their parents. There are all sorts of ways that we can make sure our girls and our boys have agency and listen to themselves. But when I hear rules, when I hear it's just better for them not to until they're engaged and then just stick with that person for life, ideally, I fear that is taking us back generations, and women 100% were not happier then. They put up with more.
I do want to separate young people from what you were talking about, adult women. I want to separate them because they're not the same species. There's so much development going on in adolescence. And adolescence, as I said, goes on till 25. So by the time you're an adult woman, you are, for the most part, developed. By the time you get to 32, you know, there's going to be stuff going on, but the major part of your personality and character development is pretty much set. And so that developing period is really more my concern. I would say, great, it's your choice. You know, if that makes you feel good, wonderful. But in young people where they're developing, I agree with you that we need more education. I'm all for more education, but I'm for so we have so much sex education right now in schools. Too much sex education, if you ask me. We're teaching 9-year-olds about anal sex. We're teaching them about genital warts. That's not something a 9-year-old needs to know, you know, in school. Be free. That's your choice. I have no problem with that. But we're not teaching about the importance of connection and emotional connection and building families. And so what do we have? We have a bunch of young people out there who are having sex, but feeling empty and lonely and depressed and anxious and not knowing why. Because we are teaching sex, but we're not teaching about connection.
Can I also say, and I don't know that it's true that in the UK that we're teaching 9-year-olds about anal, by the way, but the thing that's lacking in sex education often here is pleasure. They do not talk about how pleasurable it can be, or that girls should be, when they have their first sexual experience, ideally as young women, that are not girls, but of course they should be young women, they should be of age, that their pleasure matters. There's so many young women who at the first just go, I guess I have to do this, and he has to find pleasure in it. But learning what makes your own body
feel pleasure is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
That's those a 1950s things. Idea. The 1950s were a time, I mean, nobody wants to go back to the 1950s. You know, when the books that I write, people come up to me and they say, you want women to go back to being pregnant and barefoot in the kitchen? I'm like, what? No, we don't want to go back to the 50s because women didn't have choice and women didn't know about orgasm and they didn't know about, you know, that sex could be pleasurable. And so we don't want to go back. We want to move forward. We want to take the best of, the highlights of the past and not leave all of the good parts of the past behind and, you know, take the good parts of the feminist movement too. But there's a lot of it that's not so good. And I'm going to agree with Louise that there are so many young women and older women, but let's just say young women.
Don't point at me and say older women.
Having navigated the complexities of past ideals and their impact on modern choices, the conversation now shifts to the intriguing rise of the trad wife phenomenon and its connection to today's cultural landscape.
To the office, I picked it up, it sat on my desk for a couple of weeks, then one day I tried it. And honestly, I have not looked back ever since. I now have this everywhere I go. When I travel all around the world, it's in my hotel room, my team will put it there. Before I did the podcast recording today that I've just finished, I had a shot of Ketone IQ. And as is always the case, when I fall in love with a product, I called the CEO and asked if I could invest a couple of million quid into their company. So I'm now an investor in the company as well as them. I would love you to try one and see the impact it has on you, your focus, your productivity, and your endurance. That's ketone.com/Stephen. I'm excited for you. I am. Manosphere talk. I found this graph as well, which just shows the sort of explosion in people searching trad wife, which means traditional wife.
Yeah.
And it seems from 2024, there's been this real explosion in people searching for this trend. And you said something a second ago, Erica, about young boys in particular being more vulnerable, I think were your words, than the young girls that you're seeing.
Yeah.
So how do these ideas come together to and also link in and parlay into this word manosphere? Because this subject of manosphere has been at the very forefront of conversation.
It's everything's a little out of balance. Everything's a little out of whack. So it was out of whack in the 50s. And so we fixed it. And now it's out of whack in a different way. We went from the patriarchy of men dominating women to now we have the patriarchy of women dominating men. I mean, what we need to do is not go back, but come to the middle. We need to, it just makes common sense.
How are we dominating men, though?
Oh, my goodness. 60% of college students are women and graduate students.
That's men, not us dominating
no,
them.
No, let me finish. Let me finish. Young men are afraid of women and the power they have over them to accuse. No, it's true. In universities, it's a real thing. I know because I have two sons and, there is, again, the correction was necessary. We needed to course correct in society, absolutely. But we've gone so far. So the men were powerful and the women weren't. So the women said, give us some power. So now the women took the power and now the men feel powerless. You need a society that's balanced. It needs to be balanced. And the idea was that where we wanted to go, and the truth is that all movements often go to extremes. The women's movement, those women had to go to extremes because to change society, you have to do that, right?
So should some women not go to university? Is that what you're saying?
No, but actually I think there needs to be a balance in society of men and women. If we say that we are going to be like Amazon women and not need men anymore, the truth is that the way it works is that by the research is that women will marry at their educational level or above, and men will marry at their educational level or below. That means that because we have fewer men in college and graduate school.
I'm just going to jump in there and talk about a report that came out in 2025, which sent shockwaves across the UK. Mm-hmm. It was called the Lost Boys Report. I think we might have talked about this in a previous episode, but it was a report by the Centre of Social Justice, which highlighted how many young men are now struggling in school, facing increased mental health problems and lacking positive role models, leaving them lost and isolated. And as a result, they suggested that many of them are turning to what we call the manosphere. And to give a definition to the manosphere, because I didn't actually know what it was, the definition I have from Cambridge Dictionary is manosphere includes websites and discussion groups focused on men's rights, which often oppose feminism in some way. And just to give a sort of a top line look at some of the stats around this, By age 5, 25% of boys in the UK are falling behind in language communication skills compared to just 14% of women. Yeah. At GCSE level, boys' results are on average half a grade lower than girls. The same applies for mental health and wellbeing. Obviously, we know about the suicide rates in young men, with nearly 3.5 times higher than those of young women. Eating disorders have risen as well in young men. And from an employment perspective, as of late 2024, 15.1% of men aged 16 to 24 were not in education, compared to 11% of women, which equates in the UK to about 550,000 men. And lastly, young women are between the age of 16 and 24 now earn nearly 10% more than their male peers, reversing the traditional gender pay gap in this age group. And I could go on and on and on. Specifically, the things that I've kind of not talked about are just how family dynamics have changed. And by age 14, nearly half of firstborn children do not live with both natural parents compared to 1970. And this was really shocking. And I think it really rose an argument, which I saw play out in, I saw the Sunday Times do a big piece about it. I saw it on LinkedIn, which is, what is going on here? And is this a clue as to why we now have this term manosphere?
It's a reaction. Manosphere is a reaction to the pendulum swinging too far. The pendulum needed to swing, for sure.
I slightly disagree. So I think I spoke at the beginning about the sexual revolution being two things. So one is the ideological thing, which we've spoken about quite a lot, and the other is the material changes, which no one designed, really. Like, this wasn't coordinated by anyone. This just happened. This is just how technology goes. And I think, in general, that history should best be understood as technology, with everything else kind of running along in its wake, including ideology. I actually think a massive thing that's going on with young men, it's not actually feminism that has messed them up. It's actually technology and economics. So it's that one of the most consequential things of the 20th century and before, this is really Industrial Revolution onwards, is male strength became less important economically. Blue-collar work is less valuable than it used to be. It's less available than it used to be. It turns out, America was saying, that girls predominate at universities. Girls actually tend to be better suited to a lot of work which has flourished in this era. So, say, service sector work or working in education and things like that. There's basically been a boom in areas of life which are better suited to women professionally, and the opposite has happened with men. And I really think that a lot of what's going on with men, say, turning to the manosphere, is this feeling of being economically devalued. And there are feminists who cheer that on, but that's not basically, that pretty much has actually nothing to do with ideology. It's actually to do with just much bigger changes in the world. And we should expect, by the way, I mean, if AI continues apace, we should expect to see the same sort of social effects happening. That this, when you change how people earn their money, and particularly when we're talking about people matching up, like, women tend to want to marry a man who, I think being a provider is not quite right. I think what women really want, though, is a man who provides excellent insurance, a man who, when you've just had a baby and you can't work, or you're ill, or you want to spend more time home with your children, whatever, you want a man who can step up and can look after your family. And unfortunately, the nature of the economy means that there actually aren't that many of those men. Mm-hmm. And that makes men feel really bad, and it makes women feel resentful, and it creates a lot of dysfunction, and it's not really anyone's fault. It's just what's happened.
Things are going badly for them, I'm there. When things are going badly for me, they're there for me.
Having navigated the complexities of modern relationships and economic pressures, the conversation shifts dramatically, revealing how societal narratives have shaped women's experiences and perceptions of motherhood in today's world.
That's when the tide turned for women, where the narrative changed. So women who were loving being mothers and loving raising children suddenly were told that they were in a concentration camp and that they were prisoners and oppressed. And some of them were, and some of them probably shouldn't have had children, and many of them weren't. And even today, people write me every day and say, thank you for saying what you say, because society's narrative is so much about, we have no value unless we go out into the workforce.
So can I ask you, want to know,
What
baby boomers tended to be raised by stay-at-home mothers because financial world was totally different then. Like, you know, when you talk about very poor women, I have university educated friends who cannot afford to buy a property anywhere. They don't have parents that can give them money. They're never going to be able to save that much money. And they move out of a rented property probably once a year because the landlord moves them on. And then the boiler's not working and so on and so on and so on. And I have a local food bank that I donate food to, and I often get chatting to people. There are nurses, full-time nurses who live in London, who have two children at home, who the hospital cannot have any more nurses leave because there are not enough nurses. It's a real problem that the NHS is so understaffed. Various reasons for
in
that.
In America too.
But the nurses can't give up their job because their children would have nothing to eat. They are at food banks with a full-time nursing job. So we're not talking about, you know, I don't really know what you mean by very poor women. There are women with professional roles who will never own their own home, who are struggling to keep the lights on, struggling to put food on the table. Now, when I heard you talk on Stephen's podcast before, you said, well, look, you know, people don't want to downscale. And when my children were young, we did without things like second homes and vacations. And Erica, there is no hope for a second home now for anyone. And I understand that's different. No, your generation was different.
No, but that's why I said women who are working class and must work. There are solutions for those women that don't involve putting their children in daycare. And we're not discussing those solutions.
But do you see, listen, I would love if the government, of every government, would say, here's the option to stay home for 3 years.
Here's there are the, some.
Here, well, and great, they
Slovenia,
should be
Slovenia, Hungary, there are some.
And that is amazing. And I think lots of parents, and for me, I don't think it has to be the mother. And I've got friends who are same-sex parents and who have the most incredible relationships with their children. I don't think it has to be a mother. But I feel like there's lots and lots of parents who would love to stay home for 3 years with their children and be able to afford that and to be able to afford to get, and that corporations would then go, you know, there's a lot of evidence that if you take 3 years off to raise your child, when you come back, you've got a whole new skill set.
There's books written about it.
Oh my God,
actually,
you go back into the financial district, you've negotiated with a toddler for 3 years.
That's
right. Step inside.
Absolutely.
And yet often that is not recognized. Women are pushed out of the workforce. So I am 100% with you that attachment is important and that many parents would love to take 3 years off, and this is not being made possible by unregulated capitalism, by governments who do not care. And
I'm from America, where we don't have any paid leave at all.
Absolutely.
You know, I go and advocate on the Hill for this. I mean, I've been advocating for a decade for paid leave, and I don't seem to be getting anywhere, but I'm trying.
What are your thoughts on this, Louise, in terms of the role that feminism has had on mothers and motherhood?
And someone in the trenches.
Yeah.
So I should say, partly as a consequence of reading Erica's work and also having you on my podcast, we have moved heaven and earth to not put our children in daycare, which has involved quite a lot of like creative thinking.
Yay.
And we are poorer than we would otherwise have been. You know, and people look at us like we're crazy sometimes and think, why have you made your life so complicated? And it's because me and my husband both have this really strong feeling that we don't want to put them in institutional childcare. And that is weird. And one of the things that I really don't like in the UK policy space, and I this is true in other countries like the US too, is that governments at about the turn of the millennium seem to have cottoned on to the fact that they can use women to boost GDP. And David Goodhart, who's a friend and author, he wrote a book recently called The Care Dilemma, and he described this historical event as a one-time boost to GDP. Mm. It's not replicable. But in really the 1990s, obviously the sexual revolution predates this, but really the 1990s is when you see this massive surge of working mothers. This idea that you should be out of the house 40 hours a week, children in daycare, that's pretty new. And governments like this because governments like women paying taxes. Mm-hmm. And I think that to some extent, should we say non-maternal feminism, has been a little bit naive about this and thinking that if we can get the government to support daycare-based initiatives, that that's good for women. there's so much research on this showing that actually most women find it really, really hard. And it's a very common thing in mums groups and on social media and so on, women thinking, I do not want to leave my
66%
baby.
Of women in UK want to stay home if they bring
right,
the
or want to work, stay home more.
Yeah.
And what I object to is the current arrangement that we have in the UK and elsewhere, where the government does nothing for you if you're a stay-at-home mother. The government actually punishes families in the tax system. If you're a single earner family, you will pay more tax than if you earn the same amount but across two incomes. You are directly punished. This was deliberately established as a quote-unquote feminist policy so that it would channel women back into the workforce after they'd had children. Yeah. I also don't like the fact that the only setup that's available in terms of getting any kind of funding from the government is for daycare. You can't put money towards a nanny. You can't put money towards having a grandparent or an aunt or something.
Help you have no choice.
Yeah, the only way that you can get any kind of subsidy is through daycare. And I think that, I mean, talking about choice, that's removing choices from women.
That's right.
And most women don't want to take that choice. And they're doing it because they're being channeled in that direction by economic forces, which I object to.
But I don't think that's to call it a feminist policy, it feels like guilting women twice. What I said at the top about relieving women from this emotional burden of guilt, I feel like that's an unregulated capitalist policy. That is not a feminist policy.
I think if I heard her correctly, she said that they were using feminism in a way. They used it as a banner, but it's actually the government wanting the GDP. I mean, that's what I heard. I don't know.
Well, and yeah. Also it's a policy. The thing is that women disagree on stuff, right? So including, you know, present company included.
Yeah.
Some women, I mean, this is kind of the whole story of the second wave. There are some women who, for temperamental or life circumstance reasons, have benefited from this, for instance, pushing daycare as one example. I could list loads. There are some women who are more temperamentally inclined to work full-time, who don't like being stay-at-home mums, who find it boring, frustrating, whatever it is.
Having navigated the complexities of women's experiences within capitalism, the conversation shifts to a critical examination of feminism's evolution, revealing how some interpretations may inadvertently reinforce patriarchal ideals.
But it's also because, unfortunately, there has been this strain of feminism, it's not all feminism at all, which has basically aspired as much as possible to make women like men. Yeah. And that includes women being like men professionally, women having sex like men. That's the expression they use in Sex and the City, having sex like a man, right? Basically enjoying hookups without any real emotional connection. And I think that's a real trap for feminism, is to assume that women should want to be as much like men as possible.
Even women's bodies. Even right. If you look at teenage girls' bodies, they all aspire to be like adolescent boys. You know, they don't want breasts. They don't want hips. They want to be, right? So it is. It's almost as if we elevated, in a funny way, feminists were trying to reject patriarchy, but they ended up idolizing it and wanting to be it, and then rejecting everything feminine. And that's a problem. And it's certainly a problem for motherhood.
Yeah. And I think what maternal feminism says is, actually, maybe women are all right. And maybe actually this feminine stuff is good. And maybe motherhood is actually just as valuable as your professional life.
Yeah.
And we should aspire to feminist ideas, policy, education, whatever, which prizes that.
And how much do you see women elevated who are mothers? I mean, do you go to a cocktail party and you ask a woman what she does, and she says, I'm a stay-at-home mom and I'm raising my children. The back will turn on her, whether it's a woman or a man. And so that means that we've denigrated and not just deprioritized. We've deprioritized. We've denigrated it. We've dismissed it. We've turned it into something less than. And so remember that what helped women to feel valuable in society was the admiration for them. Feminism has to get to a place where it says, you have choice. We admire your choice to stay home with your children and admire our choice not to have children. You know, but the idea that the second wave of feminism, it was about it's all drudgery and it's disgusting and boring, and it made it into this. And now you have these websites, which are frightening to me, the scary mommy websites, where you have women saying, I hate breastfeeding and I hate pregnancy and I hate my children. And it's so disturbing to me, because what have we done to those women? What have we done to society that we have those websites? It's okay to feel frustrated, to feel bored, to have many feelings about mothering, but the hostility towards mothering, the hostility towards children, the hostility towards raising children. If we don't admire mothers again, there will be no mothers in the future.
Erica, I feel totally the opposite of that. It's so interesting, because I'm not a mother. Mm. I had a Guilty Feminist podcast episode where Susan Kalman, who's a comedian, came on and we said, what do you want to talk about? And she said, I want to talk about the fact that I've never wanted to be a mother. I said, I've tried to have children, couldn't, but I have lots of nurturing relationships, love children. I have never had more fury in my inbox. Like, we were monsters because we weren't mothers. So what you're saying is true, that sometimes someone will be like, oh, you're a stay-at-home mom, and I despise it. Being a stay-at-home parent is a job of work, and I want women to be celebrated for staying home with their children. I want men to be celebrated. Men tend to be celebrated more if they do that work. I want women to be celebrated. I want all parents of any gender to be celebrated for
that.
We
agree on that.
You said something there which links to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is if we don't correct this in some way, we're not going to have mothers. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the birth rates and the fertility rates,
50% of young women don't want to have children. So, you know, again, I'm all for choice, and I think women have to come together. So in a way, the feminism movement didn't unite women, it split women in many ways, the second wave of feminism, right? So what happened is that we took them out of their caretaking roles, and it was like taking a keystone species out of the environment. Much of the environment degraded and shriveled up. That's why we're seeing 50%. That's why we're seeing, in my opinion, that's why we're seeing such a rise in mental illness. Women aren't going to check on their neighbors anymore. They're not feeding the poor at their local church. They're really preoccupied with making money and materialism and the GDP and a world in which they are no longer caretakers. Now, not everybody's meant to be a caretaker, but the point is, once we lose that linchpin, the society degrades.
The ecosystem.
It degrades.
Is it our job to be down at the soup kitchen and checking on the elderly neighbors? We should raise our sons and daughters to do that. All children should be raised to check on. It's not women's job. I work in a writer's room at the moment, and I love it. And I am not less good in the room than any man. I get so much joy from it. It's so exciting. If we say, oh, feminism took away my key linchpin role where I have to, like, go to a soup kitchen and then check on a neighbor and check on the graphic, while men still get to go into the writer's room and create an animated feature film like it was in the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s or the 80s or the damn 90s, let's be honest, I don't get to do that. The film gets to be more male. It tells the story to the next generation, and the boys get to make that film, and the stories go on and on and on, that my role is checking on the elderly neighbor, and the man's role is to go and write the exciting movie and create
the
story.
That's not the counterpart. Men do pro-social things too. They don't just write TV shows. They fight fires, they earn money, they chop wood.
I'm talking about what Erica was saying about the unpaid labor of checking.
So can I say, I think that one of the problems we have in the contemporary world, and this applies just as much to men as to women, we talked about the manosphere earlier, is that gender roles contain both privileges and responsibilities, both of them. So men do other pro-social things, right? And I think that generally one of the problems that we have in contemporary culture, having rejected so much of traditional gender ideas, is that gender roles traditionally contain both privileges and responsibilities. So for men, the privileges are kind of obvious, like feminists have drawn a lot of attention to these. But men also have counterpart responsibilities, which includes things like dying for their country or for their family, which includes doing backbreaking labor. You know, there are all sorts of hard things that men are expected to do in exchange. I think this is the unwritten agreement, in exchange for those responsibilities, those privileges rather. Women have that too. So women have some privileges. You get to the women and children first principle when it comes to saving lives. Women are often the beneficiaries of what's called benign sexism, so men being kind of deferential to women, like nice gentlemanly men being deferential to women. There's this cognitive bias called the Women Are Wonderful principle, where people will actually, if you ask someone do you want to save a woman that you don't know or a man that you don't know from drowning, people will overwhelmingly choose to save the woman. So there are those privileges. There are also responsibilities, and they include things like caring work, which is hard, and the danger and difficulty of childbearing, which is really hard. And I think that one of the problems, and maybe this is narcissistic, I don't know, this is a touchy word, but maybe this is narcissistic, is that both sexes want the privileges without the responsibilities. And you see that within the manosphere as well. That's what the manosphere wants. They want all the privileges of masculinity without any of the responsibilities. They don't want to have to be the breadwinner for their families or to do difficult work or to risk their safety doing anything.
With the complexities of privilege and responsibility laid bare, the conversation shifts to the impact of modern media on perceptions of masculinity, diving into how explicit content reshapes expectations and realities for men.
Like, it's not like Playboy of the 50s.
Because it left room for fantasy. There's no, I mean, it's so explicit that it leaves no room for fantasy, even your own fantasy.
And is it harming men as well, Louise?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not least, one of the things that is certainly anecdotally a massive problem with compulsive porn use is erectile dysfunction when you actually try and have sex with a real human being, because you've trained your brain and you've also trained the rest of your body to only respond to this particular stimulus and to masturbation.
If I put the button in front of you, like I said to Deborah, would you press it
yeah,
to,
of course I
to
would.
End porn forever?
Of course I would. Porn is so bad for not least the porn forms. I mean, even just on that basis, in the same way that I would ban some hideously unethical industry that had nothing to do with sex. Because people, I mean, like the suicide rate among porn performers is appalling. Or like, I can't remember her name, but the most promiscuous woman in Australia, the OnlyFans model, who just last week had sex with 583 men in one day and was hospitalized subsequently, right? This is what we're talking about in practice. This is like a hideous industry. It is so bad for women. I cannot understand how feminists could endorse it. I just can't. It's one of my strongest opinions.
Would you ban saucy murals in Pompeii?
I can't. Right?
No, you can't ban anything. So would you? But there's the button, saucy murals in Pompeii. Which, by the way, is number 5 on the trends.
They're two-dimensional. I don't mind two-dimensional. It's funny. I don't mind two-dimensional. It's when it's live action. And they, actually, with video games, they did studies to show that the more realistic the video games, the more harmful they were to teenagers. And so there's something about, so the murals were two-dimensional and maybe they would be considered art.
So you would press the button to end the three-dimensional porn?
Porn, yeah.
And you wouldn't press the button?
I mean, I just think...
The button's right there, what'd you do? You can press it, no one's watching.
Okay, the wholesome couple who were really into each other, I thought this is modelling something that I think is very healthy. People doing violent things to women and like hentai porn, which I discovered in my research, which is animated porn with like Lolita-style girls that look really young and violent stuff. We need regulation and we need discussion. I am not the person to lead it. But, you know, if you would press the button to get rid of the saucy murals in Pompeii, then it's kind of erasing human sexuality, I think. And I don't know, what would you or not? Would you leave those up as a sort of little racy artifact?
What would you do, Louise?
I wouldn't put it up in a schoolroom. I mean, like, I think everyone accepts that even that really mild stuff needs to be, like, limited, if not... It needs to be limited, if not legally, then socially.
What about Statue of David? What about just the naked form?
No, I would not ban that. But Deborah, I think that this is a rhetorical trick to avoid the fact that this is the least feminist industry we can conceptualize. And a lot of feminists have really dropped the ball on this and have actually decided to prioritize their own status and their own commitment to sexual liberalism over actual real women who have been sexually tortured within this industry. And it makes me really angry. And I think that, I mean, this is true in all sorts of areas of feminism. I mean, what we're doing here is an intra-feminist argument, right? Like, we're all basically starting from the same position, which is we think that women's interests ought to be protected, that women's flourishing ought to be promoted, children's too. What we're arguing about is over how to do that. And that's an argument that's gonna go on forever and has gone on forever. And I think it's good. We should have these arguments. But if we can't start from the premise that, like, the sexual torture of women for profit is bad, then what are we doing?
Why does it make you angry? And what part of it makes you angry as it relates to feminism?
It possibly is partly from having worked with victims, I think. But I guess it's the... I guess it's the dishonesty I just don't like. I'm not accusing him of being dishonest, but I just think that this ideology is just so riven with contradictions.
Where did feminism drop the ball?
In prioritizing the interests of a small, unrepresentative group of women over the interests of other women. And I don't just mean in terms of like class or wealth, although that is a factor. I mean a lot of it is to do with personality. We've talked about agency. We've talked about some people are more maternal than others. You know, I think that one of the perennial problems with feminism is that the women who tend to sort of rise to the top and get media careers, I do realize I'm in this category, are not representative of other women and will often have preferences that are very different, which are just not shared by everyone else.
I want to ask you all a question just for me, which is something that I contend with now that the world has shifted and changed and definitions have shifted, which is about masculinity and what it is to be a good man. I aspire to be a good man. And I'd like you all to tell me one by one, what masculinity now means to you and how all of the men that have gotten to this point in the podcast and also the mothers of men and fathers of men should be raising their young boys to be good men. And how does that sort of contradict or how is that in harmony with our evolutionary nature? So starting with Louise.
I think that the key task that every society has to set itself is how to, young men in particular, have this incredible energy that can be put to good things and to bad. Like the greatest discoveries in the world have overwhelmingly been made by young men, and young men also commit the vast majority of violence, right? It's this particular group contains the most incredible opportunity and also the most incredible danger. And every society faces this problem, like, what do we do about these guys? Like, how do we correctly channel that in a way that's pro-social and antisocial. And I don't think our society is doing an especially good job of that. I mean, to some extent, we do pacify men with porn and video games, so they're less dangerous than they have been in previous eras. But at the same time, I don't think that we're deploying male talents as well as we could, and I don't think that we are encouraging men to become good husbands and fathers.
What about the provider, protector, procreator narrative? Scott Galloway has talked about that men should aspire to be providers, protectors, procreators. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, I've written about CAD and dad mode as well. Like, how do we encourage men to reject CAD mode and embrace dad mode?
What is CAD mode?
I like that. A CAD, you know.
No, he's a CAD.
Kind of
it's
a jerk.
An old-fashioned word for a man who would
a philanderer
sweep in on a motorbike or a course.
Philanderer.
Like a fuckboy. Playboy.
I wasn't going to say that, but you know.
So just to make sure I've completed my perspective of how you think about masculinity.
I think chivalry is great. I think that rejecting chivalry was a mistake. Yeah.
Okay.
But also it's not the most important masculine virtue. I mean, most of the virtues should be demonstrated by both sexes.
Yeah.
You know, honesty, whatever. But there are some which I think maybe men need to focus on more and women need to focus on.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.